Well, we read almost every day how to be happy. This will make you happy. That'll make you happy. Other people saying they're unhappy. Enormous problems with mental health because people aren't happy. And it does worry me. You know, is happy the normal state? Happy to me means positive, above normal. Sad means below normal. Therefore, I don't expect to be happy on a happy high all day. But then, of course, I have an uninformed view about these things. Fortunately, there are people in the world who make paying close attention to this. And Professor Stephen Cole from the University of California in Los Angeles is just one of those people. Stephen Cole, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thanks very much.
Well, happiness is something everyone wants to talk about. Everyone wants to have. They want to be happy rather than be sad. And you know quite a bit about this, including whether having a purpose in life provides a sense of happiness.
I do.
What can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about happiness, but I have to confess at the outset that I'm mostly an expert in misery and death. So I got into this area of research kind of through the back door, the dark side, if you will.
Yeah.
So for years, I've been studying how risky life circumstances, things like living in poverty or social isolation or having PTSD, how all of that stuff changes the way our genome functions and basically sets us up for disease. And as you might imagine, that's, you know, sort of not the most mirthful way of life. I have a lot of tolerance for misery, but even I at some point was thinking, wow, there's no upside to this life we lead.
Yeah.
What is it that we can learn about, you know, sort of how best to lead our lives?
Yeah.
We know a little bit about how to make them bad. So I got interested in this mostly by looking for resilience factors, by looking for things that people can think or do or be that would actually protect their biology when they find themselves in really difficult life circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So what it looks like we can do by and large is first not try very hard to be happy, which seems a little
counterintuitive,
but we can talk more about that later. Yeah, we're not the first to have this observation. I think you know, folks ranging from Aristotle to John Stuart Mill would probably give you the same advice. But we came to it by trying to understand when we're well, not psychologically or kind of even morally or ethically, but when we're well biologically.
Mm-hmm.
When I started looking for resilience factors, I bumped into a friend of mine that I'd gone to graduate school with, who had since become a notable happiness psychologist. She became an expert on what makes people happy and how to achieve mm-hmm. happiness in what you might call the positive emotional sense. So when we're full of mirth and glee or splendid relaxation, all of that good emotional stuff. And so I thought, this is the person to help me find resilience factors. So we set up a study where we looked at this kind of what they call hedonic well-being, the kind of happiness that's associated with just lots of positive emotional states. And somewhat to her surprise, actually, frankly, not so much to my surprise, when we looked at the biology that I normally study, which is sort of the activation of a defensive gene program that protects us when we're feeling threatened or uncertain, we found that that program really wasn't shut down anywhere near as strongly by simply being sort of full of positive emotional states as we in the general public might have expected. What we did see, though, is the measure that she was using. She uses a questionnaire that measures hedonic well-being, but also has a bunch of questions that measure a different kind of happiness called eudaimonic well-being.
Mm-hmm.
When we looked at the eudaimonic well-being measures, they, it turned out, were fabulous predictors of reduced activity of this defensive gene expression profile. This is all measured in white blood cells, the cells that are running around trying to defend us against injuries, but inadvertently also contributing to things like cancer and neurodegenerative diseases and heart attacks.
So what are these eudaimonic things?
Yeah, what is this eudaimonic stuff? So this was a mystery to me as well. As you might imagine, I'm basically a lab scientist. I have very little direct acquaintance with happiness, and I was, you know, even more chagrined to realize
Come on, you're not down the bottom of the barrel in the happiness stakes.
Not too bad, but but certainly not at the top of the barrel.
No, okay, yeah, fair enough.
So I was interested in exactly that question, and it turns out eudaimonic well-being really measures the type of happiness that comes not from feeding your own emotional machinery, but from pursuing some sort of cause or purpose greater than your own immediate self-gratification. So it's the kind of happiness that comes from trying to help other people, trying to create something magnificent, trying to discover something that no humans have seen before. It's the kind of happiness that comes from basically creating stuff, striving after a better world, helping people, anything that you could think of as a more than momentary self-gratification. It's not the kind of happiness that comes from eating tasty food or going to the mall and buying something nifty. It's spending, you know, months or years doing something great.
Right. Now, that could that include, sorry to interrupt, but just to clarify, most of the things you've mentioned are doing things for others, but could that include having a goal for yourself, like Usain Bolt, for example? I want to be the fastest, and I'm going to work on that. So it's not the short-term pleasurable things, but it is a goal.
Right.
Not one of helping others, but nonetheless a goal or purpose.
I think it could. So at this point, we don't know very well whether it has to be intrinsically pro-social or whether it can be sort of neutral with social value, but just kind of amazing and magnificent in its own right. But at the moment, there's several things we know about the way the brain works that suggest that when you're doing amazing stuff, even if it's not especially helpful to you or anybody else in the world, that can still be extremely motivating. And we know something about the biology that transmits that kind of motivation out into the body. And at the moment, that seems like a totally plausible proposition, that it's not just about helping other people. And so the Usain Bolt idea, Usain Bolt is, you know, sort of renowned as the fastest person alive. But even if there was nobody else alive, Usain Bolt would probably still be running as fast as he could because he just thinks it's awesome. And so that pursuit of the awesome, regardless of whether it's productive or helpful, looks like it can be quite absorbing and at the moment looks equally plausible as a good way of running a life and a good way of running a body as well.
So am I correct in paraphrasing this way, that if you're out doing good things, helping other people, and you've got a purpose, not just short-term, I might volunteer today but not tomorrow, you actually got a sense of purpose, a sense of wanting to do good things, and you actually go and do them, or a goal, and you actually work on it, not just something you think of occasionally, you're really doing it, that this will have, play into your brain and actually have a physical impact on your body.
It looks like it. It certainly impacts the way our genes work and the kinds of messenger RNA that gets produced in our white blood cells. There's great epidemiology studies measuring this kind of eudaimonic well-being, this kind of sense of purpose and meaning in life, and finding that people who've got a lot of it tend to live longer. And so a lot of what we're trying to understand now is, why is that? What is it in the kind of the way a body works that allows it to become more robust and resilient to disease when it's attached to a mind that has a big focal goal and kind of magnificent purpose?
I'm talking with Stephen Cole from the University of California about happiness and how you might get it. Was it you or the researcher who's a friend of yours who focused on, I won't say extroverts versus introverts, but the more gregarious people versus people who spent time alone? What's been found about the impact on your biology of that?
Well, certainly spending tons and tons of time alone when you'd rather be with others doesn't look good. And in fact, that's kind of how we got started in genomics in the first place, is trying to understand the long observed propensity for lonely people who feel kind of disconnected from humanity to, you know, get sick and die faster. I mean, it's really a very well-established epidemiological result. And that's when we first started mapping out that defensive gene expression profile. That's when we first started to discover kind of, if you will, the fingerprints of the bad life circumstances on what our genome makes of us, what our genome creates out of our kind of DNA menu of opportunities. So we'd been doing those kinds of studies for upwards of maybe about 10 years before we started focusing on, okay, what is there any bright side to life? Is there anything we can do in the context of loneliness? And recently we had a study where we kind of ran those two horses against one another. We said, if loneliness is one of our strongest risk factors for bad biology, And eudaimonic well-being, purpose and meaning in life, is one of the, if you will, greatest resilience factors. What happens for a person who has both of those things? A lonely person who's nevertheless doing something you know, magnificent and compelling with their lives? And the answer turns out to be, happily enough, that the good wins out over the bad. So the purpose in life seems to trump loneliness in terms of, you know, sort of which one ends up having the decisive influence on at least what our white blood cell gene expression profiles are doing.
Excellent. Now, you and this other researcher are working on this. Are there an ocean of people out there working on this, or is this a relatively new field of study? It's not a new field for self-help books available at airports, you know, 10 ways to find happiness. You can read so much junk about happiness, people just cashing in, I think, quite cruelly on people who have a genuine sense of unhappiness. So we know there are charlatans out there, but what about decent scientists like yourself? Are there a lot of people working on this?
Well, it depends on sort of exactly how you define this. So eudaimonic well-being in particular, frankly, there's not a lot of people working on that. Probably, you know, sort of the total number may be less than 10 or 20 or so. That said, they're, you know, they've kind of got a pretty strong hand at the moment, given the success of the studies they've done. There's a somewhat larger industry of folks who are studying just, you know, sort of how to be psychologically happy without any regard for its biological impact, its kind of health consequences, if you will. And there, that's actually a pretty healthy, robust academic discipline at this point, with, you know, certainly many tens, possibly hundreds of laboratory research scientists trying to figure out how all this stuff works and how best to be happy. So folks who are interested in that kind of thing, if you want a research-grounded portrayal of, you know, what works for happiness, there's a great book called The How of Happiness by Sonia Lyubomirsky, Lyubomirsky. And for years, she's basically tried lots and lots of different ideas and measured how happy they make people, and especially how durably happy they make people. And then Barbara Fredrickson, the woman with whom I collaborated on the studies of eudaimonic well-being, she also has a fabulous line of research that looks at some particular strategies for helping people be happier, especially through this kind of pro-social route, this route that comes from helping others, for having compassion with others, for focusing on the good aspects of life. So she's got a book out recently called Love 2.0. For people who are interested in just the psychological experience of happiness, those are two great places to start.
Is she the one that says, if you do something positive every day, that it will eventually have an impact on how you think about life?
Yeah, that's exactly right. She has a theory related to a ratio of, if you will, sort of good experiences to bad experiences that she thinks if you hit a certain critical threshold ratio, that you produce what you call an upward spiral. Your happiness tends to draw happiness from others, and that tends to make you happier, and so you get this sort of virtuous cycle. And that below that critical threshold, you know, you're at risk of a more downward spiral, where your unhappiness begets unhappy reactions from others, and you all collectively become convinced the world's a terrible place.
Yeah. Stephen, can I ask you about this eudaimonic happiness? I know a few narcissists because I spent some time in politics. It's obviously I might have bumped into the odd one. And most of them outwardly seem quite happy. Yet eudaimonic, but the pursuit of eudaimonic happiness seems to be, if I've understood what you said, that one might just say to someone in a brutal way, look, just get over yourself and get out of yourself. Get out there and do a few things for other people. Get some sort of goal in life. Stop focusing on yourself and you might feel better. Is that an unfair way to describe it?
No, I think you're on to it. I think one of the paradoxes of what we've been discovering in these biology studies is that our experience of happiness doesn't necessarily track always what you might think of as our body's experience of happiness. So we can find lots of people who have lots of hedonic well-being, but are, you know, lots of positive emotional states, but they're getting them through what Barb Fredrickson calls cheap, empty calories happiness. They you know, sort of do nice things for themselves. They you know, just sort of feed what the philosopher Epicurus thought of as, you know, sort of our positive psychology machinery. And that the route to happiness there is really just having lots of individual happy experiences. And, you know, the contrasting view was the one that came from Aristotle and lots of other philosophers, you know, again, ranging all the way up to kind of the recent past and John Stuart Mill, that really the highest form of happiness comes from, you know, this more self-transcendent route where you're trying to do something good for the world or you know, something magnificent, even if it's not especially good for the world, but you're discovering stuff or creating things. So that kind of happiness, it turns out that kind of well-being also makes you emotionally happy. So I'm beginning to suspect that there's lots of routes to emotional happiness, some through paths that are, frankly, kind of, you know, self-serving and narcissistic of the sort that you talked about, and others that you know, arrive at possibly the same state of mental well-being through a more kind of contributory or creative path. So that makes it hard, because when somebody says they're happy, and, you know, who are we to really doubt them? I mean, it's possible that people can be happy.
No, you're not. You're a fool is not the appropriate response, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Right. Well, I mean, it might be, but, you know, you'd need a lot more information than I have to be able to decide for sure.
Sure.
So what we can say right now is that, you know, that happiness, there's probably lots of different paths to happiness and lots of different flavors of happiness. And they're probably not all interchangeable, certainly when it comes to their biology correlates, the kind of the shadow that they cast on the way our bodies work. They seem to be very different.
Indeed. Well, Stephen Cole, can I say this? Today, you've made me very happy. Thanks very much for joining us to talk about the pursuit of happiness from the University of California.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
That was Stephen Cole from the University of California in Los Angeles, talking about happiness.